as we head for a high of 46 degrees. The time is exactly 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. Time for the morning show here on WGTD. Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing our last newly recorded morning show interview of 2023. It's with the co-author of a really fascinating parenting book called Raising a Kid Who Can. In part two, we'll be delving into the morning show archives for a conversation from several years ago with a filmmaker responsible for a fascinating documentary called The Boys of 36. Which tells the story of a group of American athletes whose rowing team upset the heavily favored German team at the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. It's a story that has been transformed into a major motion picture directed by George Clooney. Here's part one of today's program. If you go into any bookstore, you will find shelves that are loaded with parenting books, advice books for parents. They probably number in the thousands, if not the millions. But I have recently taken in hand probably the single best book I have ever read, or certainly the book that, if I were a parent, I think I would most want to have on my shelf, because it is put together so thoughtfully and with the reader's edification and entertainment in mind. It's a book called Raising a Kid Who Can, Simple Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Adaptability and Emotional Strength, published by Workman. It is the creation of three co-authors, including my morning show guest, Dr. Catherine McCarthy, a Duke-trained child and adolescent psychiatrist who has been doing that sort of work for nearly a quarter of a century. And she and her co-authors also come at this task as parents themselves. So this is a well-grounded, well-researched book, which is also tied in with their real-life experience as parents. The book, again, is Raising a Kid Who Can, Simple Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Adaptability and Emotional Strength. And Dr. Catherine McCarthy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Greg.
It really is a terrific book, and I'll just add once again, I'm not even a parent, never have been, never will be, but I found this book so interesting and well put together, and unlike a lot of books that are on this topic, which are kind of difficult to penetrate, I think yours is just so accessible and readable and so on. It comes as no surprise that in the introduction to the book, you and your co-authors mentioned that one of your models was those lovely travel guides of Rick Steves. Tell us more about how that was at least in part an inspiration in terms of putting this book together.
Oh, yes. I love Rick Steves. And when opening a travel book like that, you can immediately get a sense of the framework. And because, you know, we wrote this book to answer a question that parents ask a lot, you know, which is, if I can only do so much, what are the most important things for me to know when I raise my kids? So we took that, like you said, and thank you for such a wonderful introduction. All the information that's out there from an evidence base, it's really important to have everything cited perfectly scientifically and research-wise, and we combined it with our stuff from all of our years of experience, and we organized it just like a guidebook. So you can flip it open, drop in and out, and you can find a quick tip for what, you know, you might be challenged with. with your kid. There's a lot also for parents too, and you can read it as, you know, for what applies to you, or you can read it from beginning to end. It's organized so that it's super easy on the eyes, because a lot of, just for us as parents, even though we're professionals, it's even when we look at parenting books, as incredible as the information is, we want to be able to cut to the chase and not feel bad about having this pile on our bedside shelf.
Right. I want to ask you about a somewhat provocative line in this introduction or preface, I guess. Oh, you call it the welcome. That's a nice way to put it, actually. But at one point in this, you say, being an effective parent in bad times and good times is simpler than you think.
Well, yes.
Tell us what's behind those words.
Well, there's just, in just a, whether we look at, you know, how we, you know, put stuff up in the different fields, whether like decorating or here I am talking, you know, could be yammering on, less can be more. And it's not that this is free range parenting, but to look at, you know, what are the most important things? We often say that if you were stuck with the three of us in an elevator, and I don't know why I chose an elevator, but maybe it's because I got stuck in one of my building. You know, if we could only give you an hour or two of our time, what are the most important pieces? And making it ridiculously simple so that when we're under stress, our brain wants to keep things simple. And if we have these major messages and themes, knowing that we get hundreds of chances every week, if we do decent enough, maybe more than 50% of the time, not perfect, always get new tries, then that's fine parenting.
Mm. So in a sense, the spine of the book, the central framework of it, centers around 10 essentials. You say, We believe that in order to thrive, every child needs these 10 essentials. First of all, you tell us, I like the way you put this, these 10 principles did not magically appear to us. It sounds like the three of you worked long and hard to assemble this list of the 10 essentials. Tell us more about that.
We did. And so we have a nice illustration of the, you know, what we call our three lenses. So I'm a child psychiatrist with medical background. Heather Tedesco is a parent psychologist with expertise in the behavioral realm. And Jennifer Weaver is a super talented, one of the greatest child therapists around. And so we looked at all of our common denominators. What are the things that we say all day long in, you know, and then what are the pieces that we didn't, you know, we combined our information, and that each of us have a different lens and look at it. We went through parenting book after parenting book, all the research, all the citations, all that we use, and came up with, after culling it backwards, forwards. We stayed on my porch in the pandemic outside for a year, even when it was really hot with cicadas. We had, it was cold at times. It was not like what you have there, but cold enough. And we had whiteboards, and we had strong feelings about, you know, coming through a consensus, and we learned tons. So when we go to conferences, when we look at the research, when we look at our journals, when we look at the leaders in the field, these were the 10 common denominators. It's like the best hits. It's like if we could, like, have it, a, you know, group of mental health professionals in your pocket, which sounds kind of weird now that I said it.
And it is a really thoughtfully put together list that I think is great, and I'm just going to read them quickly. So we believe that in order to thrive, every child needs rest, recreation, and routine, attention skills and self-control, tolerance for difficult feelings, tools to accept and manage anxiety, psychological flexibility, independence, self-motivation, compassion and gratitude, resilience. And the 10th essential, parents and caregivers who strive to embody these essentials too, and who embrace that they themselves, just like their children, are works in progress. I suppose that's one of the abiding themes all over your book, is that that notion that none of us is a finished product, and that parents need to go into the task of parents embracing that, their unfinished state, their need to continue to learn.
Oh, that's so well said. precisely, because as much as we can say, you know, okay, we're just human, but we really are only human, and allowing kids to see us as human, not that we're going to dump on them, not that we are going to, like, hang out all our dirty laundry, but in age-appropriate ways to see that, you know, to talk out loud, think out loud how we saw things, even if they're ignoring you in the car or they've got their little AirPods on or whatever, that, you know, to know that some of it gets in and that we, as we are going through life, you know, making mistakes, learning from them, getting lots of do-overs, that we are human too. That piece is really, you know, it's at the end of the book, but it's the one thing we can control as parents and as humans, whether kids or not, we have kids or not, is how we control the controllables ourselves.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine McCarthy, one of the three co-authors of a wonderful new book called Raising a Kid Who Can, Simple Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Adaptability and Emotional Strength. Explain to our listeners how each chapter is put together.
Well, each chapter is put together, again, just in that travel guide way. It's so predictable. So in the beginning of each chapter, we give you the, you know, the main points, the bottom line. Then we give you the, you know, what is the, why is this important? Why do we pick this? Why is this worth you reading the handful of pages? We give you the science background. It's not too wordy. I believe that all parents can really understand the why, and I, as stubborn as I am, and even in doctors, you know, often make the worst patients, I need to know the why something's going to go to, you know, work for me if I'm going to do it. So if I go to exercise trainer, I want to know why, how do they know that this doesn't just sound good, but is good. And then we go into, you know, the nitty gritty, which is this is to try, you know, and we give some personal examples that are very, you know, very human ourselves, of ourselves as parents. But we give you a huge list, even though, again, in a concise way, of the tricks of the trade, what we say all day long. So again, just like having us with you, and some apply to your kids, some your kid is going to look at you with the, you know, rolling eyes, which is what rolling eyes are made for, is, you know, to be able to non-verbally express something appropriate, fine evolutionary tool. But so that we, some work, some don't, you can try them out, try them on for size, and like, that didn't. But it's all of our pearls, all of our parenting pearls from all of our years.
Mm.
And all the research.
I really appreciate that. And it's interesting that there's one spread that I especially like, which is called Playbook Pearls, in which you kind of summarize some of your very, very favorite parenting strategies, such as narrate your thought process, in which you kind of speak out loud about, you know, kind of what you're doing, what you're feeling, why you are doing what you can, and so on. And not expecting your kids to kind of read your mind, but to understand what's going on, and unmasking yourself to, you know, let kids know that you are subject to certain hurts or fears or whatever. You don't need to be the all-knowing, always perfect parent. Mm-hmm. The last of the pearls is so intriguing to me. Do nothing. You say sometimes the absolute hardest and most effective thing to do as a parent is not to do anything at all. There are actually several points in this book when you talk about the whole matter of parental over-involvement. And in this world in which parents are so tempted to do everything they can to make their kids successful and to keep them safe, I think you're saying something really useful here about how parents need to balance that with some hands off. Tell us more about what parents need to think about in this regard.
Well, up by you, not state over, in Minnesota, this big survey came out during the time that this book was, you know, being published, that highlighted Minnesota, that really kids, even from early age, all over the country, early age, no matter what background, what, you know, geographic area, that they're just get pretty spun up, worried about college from little kids on. Whether or not that's, you know, a bigger thing in the family, it's just out there, all this information. And so kids worrying and having increased anxiety, not just about school, but just never enough, never enough. So it's understandable that parents want to help their kids feel, who are feeling super anxious or stressed, whatever it is, whether it's that or social or sports. With that, we, you know, by educating, we feel in some respects the mental health community has to take a step back. You know, people have been very informed about the mental health crisis. There's increasing anxiety, depression. So understandably, parents are on the watch, pediatricians are on the watch, teachers are on the watch. But at the same time, by just swooping in and fixing it and solving it because we want to relieve their distress, we are depriving them of the opportunity to learn that they can sit with it, that they can tolerate it, and they can figure it out. Mm-hmm. Age appropriate. Again, you don't just leave, you know, a kid who can't find his mom at the bus, you know, stopped at, you know, 7-year-old, like, oh, you got a deal. It's age appropriate, but learning to sit with things, learning to tolerate it, and to know that no matter what, you can figure out a plan B. And that if you can, know you can cope, then you don't have to be afraid. But it's so hard as a parent. And at the same time, it's the most important thing. There's so many kids that really struggle once they do leave high school. And we see so much of this time right around this year, Thanksgiving, that kids feel like they're just too much all at once. And raising someone who can adapt into this modern world, I mean, goodness gracious, past few years, would we ever have thought that we could get through something like this? You know, if we look back, you know, you're going to get through a pandemic. You're going to have kids at home. You're going to have to work from home. You're going to, and then that's only putting, you know, pretty picture on it. There's so much trauma and hardship, but that really coming, looking at it backwards now, it's like, yeah, we did. Mm. And that's the dealing with uncertainty, tolerating uncertainty. We have this huge opportunity now because we had to deal with uncertainty collectively and we just had to. Is there going to be graduation? I don't know. Is dad going to be able to come home from the hospital at all? Is he going to have to live there? I don't know. Grandparents, going to be able to see him next year? I don't know. So being able to tolerate uncertainty, being able to adapt and figure out, flex, pivot, no matter what, those are the powers that allow kids for whatever happens, not just 4 years from now, but 40 years from now, to be adults who can manage, who can deal.
Hmm. Of these 10 essentials, which one do you think has come to you most recently, or maybe in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, which of these essentials is sort of newly important to you?
That is such a great question. Besides the, you know, the adaptability, being able to flex, just because we see that as now an opportunity because we all had to, is basic, and I've changed my tune about the first one of just the basics. We call it the 3 R's: rest, recreation, routine. Just to make it catchy, but it's, you know, rest meaning sleep, recreation is exercise, and, you know, other kinds of forms of movement, and, you know, doing stuff that's not school, and routine is our structure. Going back to the basics, it's given all the, whether kids been through, parents been through, sleep got really screwed up for a lot of humans in the pandemic, and still is. Adults, parents, that we got weird sleep stuff. You'd think that would have been better. And also the amount of time we have on screens, just got really used to it because, you know, we're just managing. Got it. You know, what else are we going to do? That's the way kids could connect. But so much with the screens being recreation and routine, being creeping into the nighttime, that these fundamentals, because if your brain isn't, since it's, you know, most complicated piece of living matter in the universe, I think, thus far, if we don't have it functioning like our other organs as well, you know, it's going to affect everything else. So it's the easiest gimme. If you just change one thing, not like you can make your child sleep, but if you just look at how you can slightly adjust, which we got a lot of tricks of the trade there, or how we try to encourage not always being at the screens. We talk about digital stuff at the end, which is so hard because there's just so much, you know, we're all doing our best. We can't make kids do anything, can't make other humans. But these basics just really took a toll, you know, toll in all humans of all ages, pandemic, and it's time to reclaim our brains.
Mm-hmm. The book, again, is Raising a Kid Who Can, Simple Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Adaptability and Emotional Strength, published by Workman Publishing. One of the authors, Dr. Catherine McCarthy. Dr. McCarthy, thank you for writing this wonderful book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. It was just an honor. Thanks so much. Happy holidays.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we're going to be telling you about an inspiring story from the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, in which an American team of rowers scored a stunning upset victory over the heavily favored German team to win gold. This happened before the disapproving eyes of Adolf Hitler. The story was told several years ago in a marvelous American Experience documentary called The Boys of 36, directed and co-produced by Margaret Grossi. Margaret Grossi's other credits for American Experience include Billie Jean King, Portrait of a Pioneer, and Rebels of Oakland, The A's, The Raiders, The 70s. Her other films have included Nancy and Tanya, McEnroe and Borg, Fire and Ice, and Ted Williams, There Goes the Greatest Hitter That Ever Lived. This documentary film that we talk about in this interview can be streamed on pbs.org free of charge. Again, it's titled The Boys of 36, telling the same story as the major motion picture about to be released to movie theaters called The Boys in the Boat. Can you say a quick word about what got you into the business, that is, into the business of making sports documentaries and sports films? And do you come at this as someone who was or maybe still is an athlete yourself?
I played sports in school, but I did not have the great gifts. I'm about 5'2", and I played well on a high school level, I guess. But I've always also been a fan of sports, all sports, really. But I didn't grow up knowing a lot about rowing. I'm from the Boston area, and I have friends who row and row at the head of the Charles. And I always thought it was a very beautiful sport to watch. But I had no idea how kind of grueling it is and the kind of dedication it takes to really do it well and succeed. As far as getting into documentaries, as I said, I'd always been a fan of sports, and I started my career working in sports, but more of it was sort of live television, more short form kind of sports programs, which I think was kind of what was popular. I'm older. Back in the 80s, I think it was more popular to do live television. And now that we're getting into a kind of a content age as opposed to which network you work for, I think that long form is really taking off. And for me personally, just getting a little bit more into a story, really digging out all the pieces of it, was attractive to me, so I kind of made the transition that way.
Did this particular story cross your path in any particular moment or in any particular way? I mean, or for a long, long time, have you somehow known about this this team of rowers, the so-called Boys of 36?
I did not. Mark Sammels, who is the executive producer of American Experience, sort of had his eye on this story. And he had known some of the work that we've done, our team had done in the past, and he contacted me about doing it. But once I picked up the book and started reading it, James Brown's Boys in the Boat book, which this is based on, you could see right away that this was a very visual story, a very American story, and very appealing in its underdog theme. So it was kind of an automatic for me.
Ahead of us talking specifically about these young men and their story, I think it would be helpful to our listeners to make sure they understand exactly the sport that we are talking about, the event in which these young men were entered at the Olympics, and also a word about just how very popular this particular sport was back in the 1930s for some reason. So first of all, explain exactly the sport, even the exact name of this event that we are talking about.
It was referred to, it was the the last race of the day in Berlin, and it was the premier race. It's referred to as the heavyweight eights, the eight or 2,000 meter race. And these boys were used to rowing longer distances in other races during the season. And in fact, there aren't that many races during a rowing season, apparently. There are maybe two or three. But the IRA, the national championship in Poughkeepsie at that time, was a four-mile race. This is 2,000 meters, which is significantly shorter. So it would be like asking someone who is a cross-country runner to suddenly run a sprint at the Olympics for the gold medal. So no pressure there.
And we should probably describe visually what we are talking about. And I think once we do that, people will know exactly the kind of racing that we are talking about. We're, of course, talking about a long, narrow boat, which I think is called a shell.
And that's right.
And in there would be then the oarsmen seated sort of parallel to each other, and then one person at the front of the boat serving a very important function. Explain that.
Yes. They're actually kind of stacked one behind another in rowing, as most people can see it when they watch some of these races, if they ever have. But these are big guys too. They're really big. Six feet it would probably be kind of considered average. Even at the time, Stutt McMillan, who was in what they call the engine room in the middle of the boat, he was at least 6'5".
Wow.
And they're in a shell that at the time was made of cedar, not very wide, 62 feet long, with eight of these big guys in it, having to row in complete, kind of synchronization, harmony. And then one coxswain in the stern of the boat, who is necessarily shorter and lighter, who's not rowing, who's steering the boat and commanding the boat. I can't. There's not another sport that I've, been a fan of or experienced physically that's like it. Hmm. It's one thing to think about, say, someone like me. I've, of course, been in rowboats, in canoes, in kayaks. But these big guys who could probably just as easily play football or basketball in this very sort of delicate wooden shell, trying to be in perfect sync, going down a river or a lake with the wind in their faces and the waves and competition right next to them is amazing. The amount of dedication to this is amazing. These boys also, of course, at that time had to deal with thousands of spectators in Berlin chanting in their faces while they tried to do this. It's just amazing that they pulled this off.
Absolutely. And the film says that this was a tremendously popular sport, one of America's most popular sporting events, back in the 1930s. One thing that we catch an intriguing glimpse of in your film is the view not only of certain fans just in the stands, as they might be for a horse race or a track and field event or something, but even people loaded into some sort of almost like a train car that would be yet another way to experience this race. Explain what that was.
Observation trains. That was when I saw that. That was probably the most kind of stunning visual to me. Once we were looking at through the archival footage, I don't think they exist anywhere today. But I sure wish they did, because anybody who's been to a race knows that you sit on the shore and you get one glimpse sort of during the race, because you have to sort of park yourself in one spot, and it's a little frustrating if you want to cheer for somebody that you're interested in, a team that you're interested in. This train ran alongside. The train was in Poughkeepsie. I know that there were trains in Seattle. And it ran on a track alongside the racecourse. So people could buy a ticket and sit on these trains and go along the course with with the shells, with the boats, with the competition, and the entire way, and really root for their team the entire way. It was just neat. It was just really probably Daniel James Brown wrote such a wonderful book, just a beautiful story. But I think our job, and hopefully he's kind of happy with it, was that to find visuals to go along with it. And when we found this, it's just really something to see. It's really kind of delightful in a way to see these people enjoying themselves on the train, watching these races. I wish they could bring them back today. Hmm. I think it would bring more people into the sport, frankly.
Sure.
And then the other remarkable thing for us was to see these thousands of people. And again, being a sports fan and knowing the history, I'm a big baseball fan. So, of course, I see a lot of footage from the 30s of baseball. Obviously, the fields, the stands full of people cheering, horse racing, the same thing, boxing in the arena. I would not have known this about rowing. That was kind of a startling thing to see as well. Thousands of people on piers, on ferries, on yachts, cheering for these races, these rowing races.
We're speaking with Margaret Rossi, who is the director and co-producer of an American Experience documentary that airs tonight on PBS called The Boys of 36. In it, we are learning about an American team of rowers that managed to capture a gold medal at the 1936 Berlin Olympics under the unlikeliest of circumstances. I want to be sure that we talk about sort of the background of some of these young men who were part of this team, and one man in particular whose striking personal story is told in great detail. First of all, though, I think we should talk about the strange gauntlet that was part of how the team at the University of Washington was sort of handled, and the way in which the team was constructed with these various groups of young men grouped together in various boats and so on. It's kind of a chaotic picture, and I'm not describing it very well here. I will leave that to you. But I think it's important because it's an intrinsic part of understanding the special challenge that these young men were facing.
Your struggle with trying to describe what went on there was our struggle in the edit room as well, because it's a tough, very competitive process, apparently. And at the time, was overseen by a very stern coach for these boys named Al Albrechtsen, and there are eight spots in the boat, nine really, counting the coxswain. And hundreds of boys trying out for these spots in these boats. And again, at the time, with an eye toward the Olympics, one boat that was really going to make it. Mm. So it was a very competitive process. And I think probably, I can't pretend to know all the ins and outs of how this works in a rowing season and in a boathouse with a team. But I do know that, I have felt the competitive juices in the past. And I think, again, with a sport like rowing, where you're getting up pre-dawn and you're rowing in all sorts of weather, and you dedicate so many hours to this and have to stay in such great shape, you really want a spot in that boat. And as I say, there are only really nine spots. So it was very competitive, and you had a coach who was kind of driven to get to the Olympics, sort of obsessed, who himself was a star stroke oar, it was called, in the boat the previous decade. So
never got to the Olympics himself.
He never got to the Olympics. And so that drove his obsession even more. Mm.
You
and
also
so these boys felt this. These boys really felt, I think, took on the stress and anxiety of trying to get to the Olympics.
Right. You also described this particular coach. Was his name Albrechtsen?
something? Al Ulbrichtson.
Al Ulbrichtson. Yeah. He is described in the film as being, what would the word be, maybe taciturn. I mean, someone who was not given to... to lengthy explanations, sometimes no explanations at all in terms of who exactly was going to end up in what boat. And particularly as the Olympics approached, he was not averse to setting in motion a process of sort of filtering out and shifting around, which left so many of these young men really bewildered and unsettled, not knowing where they were sort of in the grand scheme of things, and it helped create a very tense situation.
That's right. The sports writers of the day used to refer to him as the Dour Dame. He didn't say a whole lot. He wasn't someone who kind of motivated boys with a generous spirit. He, again, as we say, he was obsessed with getting to the Olympics, and so he was going to do what he needed to do to get the best boat, and this often meant shuffling these guys around in various boats to get the right combination, regardless of sort of their feelings about it. Mm. And so it created trust is such a big part of this sport. It's such a big part of success in the boat. And yet, in leading up to the Olympics, the season prior, there was an utter lack of trust in that shell house, and it cost them. It cost them for that season.
Right, and you tell that facet of the story especially well. We need to talk for a few minutes at least here about the young men themselves, and one young man in particular whose personal backstory you tell in great detail. And I just can't get over how moving and compelling this portion of the film is. Ahead of us getting that specific, I suppose as you began work on this film, you had the names of the nine young men who were the eight or young. Wait, how many are in the boat? How many are in the
show? Well, there are nine.
Okay, yeah, eight rowers and then the person at the front of the boat yelling to keep them in sync. So, yes, yeah, so mm-hmm. nine young men. And I suppose you began this with a list of nine names, but at that point not knowing anything at all about any of them. Just say a word about sort of that process of discovery, of learning who these men were, and then realizing what kind of compelling stories were to be found in their backgrounds.
Without even getting specific about one guy or another, they all were going through the Depression at the time, and they all were from the Pacific Northwest, which at the time was still kind of considered the frontier of this country. They were sort of forgotten about. They were sons of fishermen and lumberjacks, and they worked. Tim Egan in the film refers to them as grunts. You know, they had to just work very, very hard. So right off the bat, you're intrigued because the typical image of a rower is an Ivy Leaguer, you know, an East Coast Ivy Leaguer. So that's who, as a whole, as a group, that's who these boys were. Then we got to know a little bit about each of them. Not one of them came from privilege. And many of them had to do, had to get to school in the first place with no money. A lot of them went without food. Again, as Tim Egan says in the film, a lot of them came to the university so they could get fed. This was the Depression, after all. Roger Morris had to help his father move families out of their homes because they couldn't afford to pay rent on the homes anymore or mortgages. That's a lot to put on a kid, on a young kid, watching, right. having to remove families from their homes.
Yeah.
But then there was Joe Rantz, who was pretty much the main character in the book. He was abandoned by his family. He lost his mother when he was 4 years old to cancer, and then times got even tougher. And his father and his stepmother tried to keep going, tried to kind of create a new family, and Joe was sort of left out on the fringe of that family. His stepmother had some issues with him, apparently, and he was left behind. But as we find out, that wasn't a rarity during the Depression. A lot of families had to kind of leave some of their children behind to fend for themselves because they just couldn't feed them. I can't fathom that, but
right.
That's what went on.
And in, of course, the case of Joe Rance, this ends up being, I was going to say a young man, but the first time his family essentially abandons him, turns him away, he's 10 years old, forced to live at the schoolhouse, the local schoolhouse. And
That's right. And
later on in his life, where you describe the scene where his family has packed up the car and are moving to a new community, but... leaving Joe behind, he does not get to come with them, and he is essentially on his own to fend for himself as a young teen. What among the many remarkable aspects of that story is not just that Joe Rance doesn't turn incredibly bitter and sour and sort of walk down a road of self-destruction, but that he even manages to stay in school throughout all of this tumult in his life. It really leaves us with great admiration for him and for his character, which is so severely tested by all this.
Well, you're hitting on the thing that resonated with me the most, the thing that stuck with me the most about this story is, without romanticizing it too much, I would often take a pause as I was reading the book or reading articles, researching for this, and kind of let myself long for that sense of purpose that these boys had. I mean, you feel a great deal of admiration for these boys and for Joe Rance because, as I say, it would have been enough for me to try to get a job and get through school and get myself fed under those circumstances on a daily basis. But these boys were learning to row on top of it and learning about higher virtues like trust and character. You know, I think the hard work ethic was probably already there. Mm. But it wasn't for Joe Rance just a matter of survival and taking care of himself, as he had to do for most of the early part of his life. He then had to learn those higher virtues, especially trust, trusting in the other guys.
Right.
That had to have been a very, very difficult... It's one thing to talk about it, but on a daily basis, it had to have been a very, very difficult thing to do when all you knew was to take care of yourself for really your survival, not just your livelihood, but your physical survival.
Right.
So that was... quite a remarkable story.
Hmm. One of the saving graces in young Joe's life is when his older brother is able to finally extend a hand of welcome for him to come live with him in, I believe, Seattle. And so he spends maybe his last couple years of high school with the first real stability and love that he's experienced in his life. And another figure who is important in a sense in his redemption, particularly as a young athlete, is not so much the coach of the Washington team, but an intriguing gentleman by the name of George Pocott, the person who is responsible for designing and building the shells, those boats that in which they row. But he also seems to have played an important role in Joe Rance's finding himself and achieving the greatness which was always within him. Say a word about Joe Pocott.
George Pocott was a wonderfully spiritual character, and I think he was if not the difference maker for these boys, at least one of them, very significant character in the story. He was a quiet man, a spiritual man, a man who was very proud of his craft, who really respected his craft and respected I'm trying to get the words here. He really had a great amount of respect for the sport and for the craft of rowing. And he used that to show these young men that how to respect something, how to trust in something, and how that made you better as a human being. Mm-hmm. And he took Joe Rance aside and really tried to impart this to him. And I think more than just whatever words transpired between them, George Pocock was right there. His boat shop was above the shell house. He was there every day, and he was a quiet man going about his craft every day. And I think that speaks louder than words for these boys. To see that the dedication and the respect that he had in a very quiet way, he just set an example for them. And Joe picked up on that.
It makes all the difference in the world. Your film takes us through several years of spirited competition there at the university and early successes for some of these rowers as freshmen, a difficult second year, and then redemption is eventually theirs. A last quick question. One of the most interesting bits of drama plays out in Berlin when one of the most crucial members of this crew is stricken with serious illness to the point where the coach wants to pull him the morning of the race and set in an alternate. Explain what the team's response to that is.
This is, you know, as we go along through the film, and we see these boys learn about trust. We see them learn what happens when there's a lack of trust, and then we see them learn how to trust and what the strength that they gain through that. And I believe at that point they had become so strong as a team and trusting each other so much that this young man, Don Hume, who had become very ill as they were going into the gold medal race, there was a Coach Albrechtsen was possibly going to replace him, wasn't sure he could row. These boys, his teammates, stood up for him and went to this coach, this formidable coach, this very stern coach, and let him know that they wanted him with them. If they were going to row this race, no matter what happened, they wanted to do it for each other. And I think when you get to that place, that's the culmination, really. Even more to me than the gold medal. Because that's character, and that is something that you can carry through all of your life.
Margaret Grossi was director and co-producer with Mary Carrillo of the American Experience documentary The Boys of 36. The film can be viewed free of charge at pbs.org. And a major motion picture based on the same story, The Boys in the Boat, will open nationwide on Christmas Day. It's exactly 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Next week, our studios will be closed because of the holidays, but you can still enjoy a morning show each and every day next week and the week after by subscribing to the podcast version of the morning show. We will, however, be next week sharing some of our most memorable morning show conversations from 2023. And it's a long list of worthy possibilities. And I hope that you will make a point of tuning in to the Morning Show podcast next week when you have the opportunity. To subscribe, you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through all of the major podcast providers, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and Spotify. And if you think of it, please leave a positive review. It helps other listeners